Rebecca Carroll, and this is Midday. When Patience Ibrahim was just 19 years old, her husband was murdered by Boko Haram. After leaving her village, remarrying, and becoming pregnant, Boko Haram soldiers abducted Patience, forced her to convert to Islam, and held her captive for months. She told the story of how she managed to escape with her child to journalist Andrea Hoffman, who details Patience's harrowing experiences in her new book, A Gift from Darkness, How I Escaped with My Daughter. It's published by Other Press, and I'm pleased to have Andrea Hoffman with us now. Hi, Andrea.
Hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm fine. Hello from Berlin.
Hello. So what brought you to Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria to begin with?
Well, I got to know this German former missionary. She's working in the church, and she went to Nigeria about 10 years ago in order to do Christian missionary work. And she was staying just in the area that Boko Haram took. And so she felt responsible for the Christians there, and especially for the women. She was especially caring for the women who were widowed by Boko Haram, because she's herself a widow, and she's helping them with a charity, and she was telling me about it. And so one day I decided to join her when she was going there in order to deliver donations in Maiduguri. And we stayed together in a churchyard, actually, inside a church compound, because Maiduguri is quite dangerous for, you know, Westerners, people with white skin. And that's where I met all these women, and Patience was among them.
And so you mentioned, you know, it being very dangerous, of course, and particularly for white-skinned or white people. What was the process of making this decision? How did you keep your fear at bay? And what was sort of your mental or emotional sort of tenor going into it?
Well, you know, this thing with Boko Haram happened just at the same time ISIS took all this territory, and you know, everybody looked at Syria and Iraq and was caring about ISIS, because ISIS is dangerous for us, for Europe, for the US, and nobody even took notice of what was happening in Nigeria, which was just as bad. And since I, you know, I as a journalist, I was doing the same thing. I was in Iraq, but then I realized that these things were happening parallel, and I found it so astonishing and really incomprehensible that we do not care about these people in northern Nigeria. And I wondered why. And I thought that we should have a look what's going on there too, because they deserve it just the same.
Let's just talk about that for a second, though, that when you say mm-hmm. no one cared, why don't we care? First, let's establish who that no one is, and then also talk a little bit about the climate now that is created under this administration in regard to Africa as a continent at large. So when you say no one cared, you mean mainstream media, or?
Yes, mainstream media, because the declaration of the caliphate in Nigeria was in the summer of 2014, you know, just the same time. And all this mainstream media, including my own magazine, and I'm sure it was the same in the U.S., were covering that. And we, you know, we were getting engaged militarily, although it took us a while. And we didn't pay the same attention to Nigeria or to Boko Haram and the people there. So that's unjust. And you know, when you go there, this impression even deepens, because nobody is taking care of the refugees. Nobody gives them food, and Okay, you know, that's one side of it, that the West doesn't care. But even inside Nigeria, they are considered not important, because Nigeria is a wealthy country, and the South doesn't really like to think about the North, where all these terrible things happen.
And so how does northern Nigeria's population compare to the rest of the country in terms of economic and social development?
Oh, they are much poorer than the South, much lesser educated, and then, of course, the majority of them are Muslims. And, you know, the oil wealth and all that is happening in the South, and they are very reluctant to get engaged in the North. Even the military is afraid of Boko Haram and just doesn't want to go there.
And what is the trajectory of that sort of divisiveness between the North and the South?
I think it has to do with economics and with history, of course, because the North was independent for a long time. They just joined the whole of Nigeria with independence, and so they are in the South, they are not really considering it part of their country, and so.
And how long has Boko Haram been active in Nigeria, and what is the purpose?
They have been active for over 10 years, actually, and it gradually increased their engagement. You know, I've heard about them a couple of years ago, actually, and it was said, oh, they are this weird sect, you know. But even I didn't really pay much attention to them until lately, you know, until this whole thing with the Chibok girls happened and they really took territory. I guess that's when you start to notice what's actually going on. But before that, they were, you know, committing terroristic acts, and, you know, it was just happening in northern Nigeria, so wherever, right?
Yes, yes.
And that's our attitude.
And you mentioned the Chibok schoolgirls. What kind of effect did that have on the way that the rest of the world viewed the Boko Haram?
I think that was the time when we noticed that they exist as a group, you know, because it was such a huge thing. But then we sort of forgot about them again. You know, it was a hype for about a month, maybe, you know, and we had this internet petition of free our girls and so on. And then we just quietly forgot about them again.
And why is that, do you think?
I think, you know, it goes into the direction that you just mentioned. You know, it's Africa, and many terrible things happen in Africa, and we just choose to look the other way. And, well,
yeah.
You named it. This administration doesn't make me very hopeful that's going to change in the good way.
And you said many horrible things happen in Africa. Many horrible things happen in every part of the country, and certainly in the West. I wonder, you know, when President Trump said, you know, referred to Africa as a s-hole. I don't think I can say that on air, but his own information or lack thereof. Mm. Comes probably from the same place as the people that you were talking about early on, about who don't care. So how do we flip that?
It's maybe looking at the human, at the human stories. Actually, it's what I'm trying to do with
right.
this book. You know, look at one person, one woman, and looking what has happened to her,
right.
And when you get down to it, to one person, it's easier to relate, you know, and it makes it even more terrible, because otherwise it remains abstract. Oh, there's something terrible happening somewhere in the world. I don't know where that place is. You know, I never looked at a map to find out. But if it's one person, and you know how she lived before all of that happened, and you can relate to her and her feelings and how she went to school and, you know, how she pictured her life to be. And then all of a sudden this happens to that girl, to that woman. You know, to me that's always this feeling, oh, you know, she was leading a normal life. It could happen to any of us, you know. It's a catastrophe that none of the people living there had foreseen. Nobody could have pictured something like that. So many times, if a catastrophe like that, it's like a tsunami. You don't see it coming. You don't expect something like that to happen in your own life until it happens.
So let's talk about patience. How did you meet her?
Well, I met her in the churchyard, actually. She was there with her little child, the one that has survived with her in captivity, and she was actually looking for food. And this lady I went with, she was distributing food for the widows, and so that's how I became to know some of them, and they told me their stories. And you know, patience was very outspoken about what she had experienced, and I was very touched, and I thought, oh, you know, she deserved, we have a closer look at her and what happened to her.
And so in your conversation,
actually all of the women, for me she's just an example of, you know, there are thousands of widows in that place in Maiduguri, and they are all, you know, left behind with children, most of them with children. They don't know what to live off now and what their future will be, and she's just one of them, and you can relate to her.
I imagine that is difficult, you know, to choose one story to tell. How did you come to decide to tell Patience's story?
I think it had to do with her, you know, her personal charisma, and how I could connect to her. I think that's very important if you do a project like that. She felt she had confidence in me. She wanted to do it.
And when you were your conversations, were you speaking with a translator, or what language were you speaking?
I was speaking with a translator. She is actually, she's a former English teacher, and she was speaking to patients in Hausa. And then translating it into English for me. And because a patient just doesn't speak English at all, and she speaks Hausa and the language of her village.
She comes across as very strong-willed in the book. And I was, you know, thinking of some of these horrific, I mean, obviously it's a difficult read. But she's very strong-willed. Is that who she was, her personality, or her religion, or her family, or culture?
Actually, the women there are raised to not be that way.
Right,
are raised to keep quiet, you know, to basically shut up about their feelings and everything, and just do their household chores and care for the kids. So no, she wasn't raised to be like that. But I think in extreme situations like that, you really grow in your character, either in a positive or in a negative way. Mm. And in her case, obviously she grew in a positive way. She, you know, she decided for inner resistance, and she's a very religious person, so her religious faith gave her strength. She was praying all the time, talking to her God, and that way she could endure all of that, and that way she preserved her dignity and her character, no matter what they did to her physically.
You mentioned she's very religious. She's a Christian.
She's a Christian, exactly. She's a Christian, and they are all very religious in the Christian community, but I think the captivity even strengthened her, because it was something she could hold on to, something nobody could take away from her, you know, her secret prayers, mm-hmm. and all of that. And when you think about it, they can take anything from you, they can treat you the way they want, but they cannot access your thoughts, your belief, your religion. That's something that stays.
I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I'm speaking with Andrea Hoffman about her new book, A Gift from Darkness: How I Escaped with My Daughter from Boko Haram. We'll be right back after a break. Rebecca Carroll, and this is Midday. I'm speaking with Andrea Hoffman. Andrea, you in the book, you alternate between voices in each chapter, your voice and then Patience Ibrahim's voice. How did you choose to frame it that way?
Because I figured that our way of thinking is quite different. And I wanted to give her a voice that is adequate and that's original, you know. I didn't want to make her too analytic or anything. You know, she should be patient and herself. And on the other hand, I wanted to, you know, insert some political information, some historical information, the way I see it as a foreigner to that country, and explain some things more in depth. And so I thought that was a good way to transmit that, to change between her voice and my voice, and of course the different perspectives. That really worked for me.
As I was reading it, I was thinking, you know, and you're saying now you wanted it to be her voice, or she wanted her to be Patience, but and yet she speaks an entirely different language, right? So we're reading it in English, and you're reading it in English, and did it feel like Patience?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. Because she was very graphic in her way of describing things. So I think, yeah, and she shared her thoughts with me and how she felt. And I was trying to put that as genuinely as I could, you know. And she identifies with the book, you know. She has it by now. And she's, you know, she's very proud of it, and you know, her cover on the front, and she, so it's her project. She wanted me to write down her story.
And if you could describe her, just in terms of her presence and her lilt and her, you know, sense of humor or the sound of her laugh, how would you do that?
She's a very, very beautiful woman. She has this, you know, she's very tall and very serious, very elegant, very skinny, and she has a beautiful face and has this aura, and she doesn't laugh a lot. I wouldn't say she has a great sense of humor, but she's very, very honest. Very honest, very serious about everything she says.
She in the book, in her life, she was married, and mm-hmm. then her first husband was Yusuf, was killed. Right? Can you tell me a little bit about that? How that happened, and where they were living, and what their lives were like.
You mean the very first husband, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That was her first marriage, and she was very young when she married him. I think only 15, if I'm not mistaken. And he was a shopkeeper, and she didn't live in her parents' village anymore. She had just moved in with him and was living with him for a couple of months. And Boko Haram raided his shop because he was Christian, and they killed him there, right in front of her. So that they didn't take her at this occasion. That was when they came into the village, when she was taken with her. She was already married to her second husband, who who was killed by Boko Haram afterwards also.
The first marriage sounded very much like, you know, it was a marriage of convenience and she was grateful for it, but it didn't seem that she was emotionally invested really as much in the first husband as with the second. And so do you feel that she was in love?
No, it didn't. It did not really sound like it when she talked about that. The second husband. She was.
Yeah.
She was. You know, he was not the perfect husband because he was married and she was supposed to be the second wife and she didn't know that, but she was in love. She, you know, they had secret meetings and he kissed her, so she did feel this, you know, funny feeling in the stomach, and she really liked him, and but she was very disappointed when she found out that he was already married and that she was supposed to live with him as his second wife.
Right, and so, how does she meet him, the second husband?
The second husband, and she meets him when she is back from her first marriage. Actually, she has to go back to her parents, and it's awful for her because widows do not count very much in northern Nigeria. They are seen as a burden and potentially as bad girls because, you know, they might steal other women's husbands. So her father is very reluctant to take her back. And she actually has to do some housework for her uncle to earn her own living, you know, so the family doesn't have to pay too much money for her. And, you know, she doesn't know if she will ever get another chance in her life to have her own family. So she's very happy when this handsome man shows up at the gate of the property, and he's with some friends of his, and they ask for some water. That's something you can always do in northern Nigeria because of the temperatures. You know, you cannot deny anybody who asks for water. So she gives them water, and they start talking and chatting. And
so, well, they have this relationship. They get married. It's not ideal. And then she's abducted by Boko Haram.
Yeah, she is abducted just, I think, about 6 weeks after they got married. So she thought her life has settled again. You know, she's relieved about it, although she's the second wife. But she has a home again, and she has a life again. And then when she goes back to the hut to prepare the dinner for all of them, they are still in the mountains. Boko Haram raids the village and they take her.
And what was it like for Patience when she first arrived at the Boko Haram camp?
They didn't take her to the camp straight away. They took her to an intermediate place where they sorted out the men from the women and the older women from the younger women. And so she's put in that group where all the young women go, and they take her on a truck, and then they drive her in this swamp area. You know, they drive her basically out of civilization, out of, you know, decent roads, and then she arrives in that place out in the swamp without, it's not a proper camp actually, it's people underneath trees, and they have some plastic to protect themselves from the water that's beneath and above them. So it's pretty awful, and she's very shocked to arrive there. And she meets some women she knows from school, and they have been there before. And then so they tell her more or less what's going on there, and she's completely shocked and cannot believe where they have taken her.
So there are a couple of moments of her descriptions that are quite vivid and horrifying. One is she's pregnant, right, when she's abducted.
Yes.
And she needs to hide her pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Yeah, she is newly pregnant. She already knew she was pregnant, but it doesn't show, you know. She's in her second month. So, yes, but she knows she is pregnant, and she has to watch some terrible scenes of what Boko Haram does with pregnant women.
And then the other, which is quite violent, as she has described it, and then also there's another moment where she's talking about a soup that the prisoners are served. What's in the soup?
Well, according to patients, it's human flesh.
And so, you know, the other thing about the pregnancy, I mean, I guess I'd rather have you describe what she told you happens to pregnant women.
Oh yeah, it's terrible. Not only her, other women have witnessed it the same way she described it. So they tell them to lay down on the ground, and they have these big machetes, and they split open their womb and tear out the fetus. And they leave the women bleeding to death, and they kill both of them because they don't want Christian babies, because they consider the babies, the unborn babies, Christian breed.
And so I read in a couple of other interviews you did, I mean, as a journalist, this kind of story and testimony is, you know, it's horrifying, and there is this sense of, well, did this actually happen? But my sense of that's not the right question. It's like, why would patients have any reason to make something like that up? And I feel like, or I wonder if our approach, certainly as Western and mainstream media, is to not believe first, or to question too rigorously, and if you felt sort of, you know, somewhere in between, you know, being, having your journalist hat on and making sure that all of these things were verifiable, or just sort of saying, okay, it's a new day, I'm going to approach this in a different way and really give all of the agency to patients.
Well, yeah, I felt that patients had a right to give her testimony, and that was a very important part of her testimony. She stressed it, she repeated it, you know, she described it very vividly, so I felt it was her right to say it. And honestly, I don't think she made any of that up, you know. When I hear that, it's like, you know, some people say women make rapes up. Why on earth would a woman or anybody do that, you know?
Right.
Of course, as you say, you know, I also had my journalistic hat on, and I would say, okay, oh, that's so horrible, and it's so strong, I have to check it somehow. But you know, how they treat pregnant women, I could check it with other women. They told me the same thing. The cannibalism, I could not 100% check it, but I felt she's the one who witnessed this, and it's her testimony, and she has every right to say it, and it's very important to let people know, to let the world know, and you know, maybe someday, hopefully, all of this will be analyzed in a proper way, or maybe even taken to court, and it will be very important to not leave anything out.
And how is she ultimately able to escape?
She has help. She has help two times, and that was interesting for me as well, because she, you know, not all the Boko Haram fighters are very happy with what they do, apparently, and so some of them try to escape as well. And so she had one friend who knew that he was not seen, he was not appreciated by the group anymore, so he was afraid they were going to kill him, and before they could do that, he took a group of women, apparently walking them to the river so they could fetch the water, because that was one of their chores. And then he just told them to keep on walking. And that's what they did. You know, they realized, oh, something strange is going on. He didn't tell them he was going to escape with them. He just told them, you know, forget about, you know, fill get your water, and then we just keep walking straight in the other direction, not back to the camp. And then they passed another Boko Haram control, and he was telling them something, we are going to this other camp, you know, something. And then after a while, he just told them, okay, that's it, you're free.
What draws you to this kind of work? This is not the first book you've co-authored, the first harrowing story.
It's these women.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I didn't have time for that last question. I have to wrap.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Andrea Hoffman about her new book, A Gift from Darkness, How I Escaped with My Daughter from Boko Haram. Thank you so much, Andrea, for speaking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.